the Gaza Strip as well.
I want to go back to Yumna El-Sayed. Last year, we spoke with you in Gaza shortly after an Israeli airstrike had just killed the family of your colleague, Al Jazeera's Gaza bureau chief, Wael Dadu. He learned of the deaths of his wife, son, daughter, and grandson while reporting live on the air. The Israeli strike on the Nusayrat refugee camp killed at least 25 people in total. And while Dadu had fled to the refugee camp with his family after Israel ordered residents of northern Gaza to vacate their homes, this, Yumna, is what you said then.
When we say there's no safe place in Gaza, we're not lying. We're not being biased. We're not exaggerating. The north, Gaza City, and the South, they're all just the same in terms of bombardment, in terms of targeting, and in all the life conditions.
So that was last October. Before this, we spoke to you, Yumna, in 2021, when you were reporting in Gaza, and Israel bombed and leveled a 12-story building that housed the offices of media organizations that you worked for, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. Israel claimed without evidence the building was being used by Hamas operatives. What do you think the message is that was delivered to the media by this attack on the main media offices, Al Jazeera and AP, where you work, other media organizations? Now Tony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, saying he was not told of any direct evidence of Hamas working in this building.
Yes, and I'm sure that there isn't going to be any. I mean, the Israeli army, when it has the proof for anything to back its story, it provides it at once, instantly. I mean, it wants to back its story. It has to, okay? But it's not a coincidence that three towers hosting media offices would be completely destructive. This is no coincidence. I mean, this is just a deliberate targeting to the media's voice in the Gaza Strip.
So that's Yumna El-Sayed. In 2021, you notice there we're not seeing her face because the media building that we would talk to her in was blown up, that housed Al Jazeera, that housed AP. And then speaking again after, well, at this point, we're talking about something like 174 journalists and media workers killed in Gaza. If you can talk about the significance of this. And in your reporting on this documentary, the killing of journalists, in addition to doctors and nurses, paramedics and ambulance drivers, Yumna.
Well, Emmy, I've always said this, and I continue saying it, that every single time there is a war or a conflict in the Gaza Strip, military escalation, something that was so much easier than what we have been going through for the past year, this ongoing genocide, there was always an attack on the journalists and their offices in the Gaza Strip. In 2021, the largest three towers, media buildings, housing all media offices in Gaza were completely destroyed. Al Jawhara had over 50 media offices, Al Shuruq Tower the same, and Al Jazeera and the AP as well. In that tower alone. This is Israel's first approach towards journalists and their offices in Gaza at the beginning of any war. It's always to try to make their job as difficult and as impossible as ever. And it's not just in wars and military escalations. I mean, at the protests of the Great March of Return, when we used to cover these protests, and these protests were taking place in the borders, on the borders, and from the Palestinian side, where there is a buffer zone of 300 meters away from that security fence that was infiltrated on the 7th of October, when someone approached those 300 meters away from the security fence, they were shot. and we were labeled as journalists, and even away from that area, we would be targeted with gas grenades that drones came and dropped them over our head. So it was not a coincidence at any of those times. This time, we've always spoken for many years about the suppression and oppression and violations and aggression of the Israeli army towards Palestinian journalists. But this year or last year, this suppression and oppression and fight against the freedom of press has not only been against the Palestinian journalists. If you've seen, it has reached and affected all international journalists as well, because Israel has banned them from entering the Gaza Strip. And no matter how much letters they have issued, no matter what kind of pressure they have tried to put on the Israeli government to allow them to enter the Gaza Strip to do their legitimate responsibility and work, they were banned. They were declined. So that oppression that we have been speaking about for years has also affected the international journalists today. But on the other hand, the violation, the aggression against the Palestinian journalists, because we are Palestinian and we are inside the Gaza Strip, has been unprecedented. The killing, 175 Palestinian journalists until today have been killed. How many others, dozens others, have been injured? And our families threatened and killed and injured. Unimaginable numbers.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Yumna El-Sayed, Al Jazeera correspondent based in the Gaza Strip, though speaking to us from London. And Richard Sanders, director of Al Jazeera iUnit's new feature-length documentary, Investigating War Crimes in Gaza. Next up, we'll be joined by the acclaimed Palestinian photographer Motaz Azeza, who repeatedly risked his life to document Israel's war on Gaza. Stay with us. Tawil performing this past weekend in Brooklyn at an event honoring our next guest. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We're joined now by the acclaimed Palestinian photographer Motaz Azeza, who at the age of 25 has become world known for documenting Gaza. For the first 108 days of Israel's brutal assault on Gaza, Azeza risked his life to show the world what was happening. In doing so, he gained over 17 million Instagram followers and emerged as one of the most prominent photojournalists in the world. Since evacuating, Azeza has become a global advocate for Gaza. GQ Middle East magazine named Azeza its Man of the Year. Time put him on its list of 100 most influential people of 2024, and he's been nominated for the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize.
Motaz Azeza is in the United States as part of a nationwide speaking tour titled Gaza Through My Lens with UNRWA USA, the nonprofit that supports the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. In a moment, he'll join us from Washington, D.C. But this is the video produced by UNRWA USA describing Motaz's work with the agency. The clip begins with UNRWA USA's Mara Kronenfeld, but first, Leila Mochaiber.
Gaza is one of the most beautiful places in the world, and that beauty was documented by a young photographer named Motaz Azeza for years. Eager to show the world, his culture, his people, rainbows, it's sunsets, it's trees.
Even with this blockade, there was so much life in Gaza. And we thought we need somebody on the ground who can show us that life. And also, of course, can show us the importance of education and health and shelter assistance that UNRWA is providing to those in Gaza.
When I eventually was looking for a photographer on the ground to capture stories to help show the people of the United States the real stories of Palestine refugees, I convened some of Gaza's greatest around a table at El Dira Hotel, a place I'll forever cherish and miss. Among us were the late Dr. Rafat Alariyad and others.
Layla collected many applications. One was a lovely woman named Amjad, and one was Mu'taz. That day that those two were selected changed us in so many ways as an organization, and frankly changed us each personally as well. Seeing Mu'taz suffer along with all Palestinians in Gaza and see him, and I'll never forget this, seeing him holding a bloodied child, a girl, and taking her speeding to the hospital, and he had never learned to drive before that moment.
Nobody in Gaza, in all of Palestine, chooses to be a hero. This includes Mu'taz. Once I asked him over ice cream, what is the number one thing you wish the world knew about Gaza? And this nerdy photographer, whose favorite thing was capturing people's faces and pretty sunsets, he just had this sad look in his eye, and he said, that we're human. He never wanted to be a hero. He just wanted to survive.
A video by UNRWA USA about our next guest, the acclaimed Palestinian photographer Mu'taz Azeza. He's joining us now from Washington, D.C. Mu'taz, it's great to have you with us on Democracy Now! I wanted to go to the picture of that introduces you on this tour that you took across the United States. You're sitting in the rubble. So, of course, this is not a photograph that you took, but a picture that a photographer took of you, the photographer Fuad, who was killed. Can you tell us about Fuad and then talk about your work for that 108 days in Gaza since October 7th?
Thank you for having me, Amy. His name is Fuad Al-Khamash, and he was a volunteer with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. He was doing his voluntary work, documenting the work of the BRCS on the ground, saving lives and transferring the injured people to the hospital. He was a dreamer, and in that day it was like a massacre when he took this picture for me in my town. I was documenting and this massacre, and he just shouted to me, Mu'taz, just I'll take a picture of you. Less than 2 months, Fuad was killed beside his like four of his colleagues in the BRCS. They didn't know that the Israeli tanks will be on Salah al-Din main road in Deir al-Balah city. They didn't expect it, and they just found the Israeli tank in front of them, and he was inside the ambulance. Unfortunately, we couldn't find a body for Fuad and other colleagues. They opened fire on the ambulance. They killed everyone inside.
So, Mu'taz, I want to go now to another photo of yours. This one is of a young girl stuck under rubble after her eight-story building was bombed by Israeli warplanes. Time magazine named it one of its top 10 photos of 2023. The woman lost seven of her family members. She was evacuated to Tunisia. She's now facing the amputation of her leg. So tell us about this woman and how you've come to advocate for her.
Actually, she's a young girl. She's now 18 years old. And there was like an Israeli occupation bombed the eight-story building in a Nusayrat refugee camp. So I was there with other colleagues documenting what's happening, and civil defense beside civilians are trying to help to save people from under the rubble. More than 180 people got killed that day. In this moment, we were hearing her shouting, but nobody was seeing her. So I used the low shutter speed with my camera to in a small hole so we can find her, and we found her. Everyone's trying to get her out, but unfortunately she's now really facing amputation for her leg. Let's say I feel she's lucky that the world now see her picture. Everyone like saw his picture around the world, but there are others, thousands of children, thousands of young girls, thousands of women, thousands of elderly. Nobody is welcome to them, and they really need the help. So I'm trying my best through the pictures, through the images of the people to help them themselves, because yeah, this picture had been selected by the Time as a top one of the top 10 pictures around the world for 2023. But the person in the picture needs the help, not just like I want to be recognized for the picture. We need to help the human themselves. I want to save the lives through the pictures.
So, Mataz, I want to ask you about your journey, how you became a photographer. You never wanted to become a war photographer. That is what you've ended up becoming. But talk to us about how you became interested in photography and how you documented life in Gaza through photography.
Photography was my passion since 2014. I started to practice photography. I had my first camera in 2015. My cousin sent it to me from, he was living in the US, Miami. I hope he's now safe. For the hurricanes that's happening there, help everyone be safe. I start to take pictures for the life, the simple life in Gaza. I start to take portraits. I start to be a dreamer who wants to travel the world, take pictures, and everyone knows his name. But I never expected the world will know my name beside a genocide of my people. So I was always trying to make art from the pain and the beautiful pictures in a place that, like, every month there is aggression, every time there is a bombing, every time there is people losing their lives by the Israeli airstrikes, by the Israeli snipers. I was like a volunteer. I went like since like 2016 with the BRCS. I was having my camera, and 2018 I got a shot in my left femur while taking just pictures because I was near to the borders with the BRCS. Trying to save lives, because this is a thing I'm loving. I'm trying to use myself to save my people, and the same thing, to take pictures. So I kept the practicing photography, but every time the war, it grabbed me to it. I've been always trying to avoid taking pictures of war, but this is my life. This is our lives. So you can't run from the war that's happening in your home. And this is what I did. I used, in this time, and every time, this is not my first time to document a war. I documented massacres since like 2017 with my camera. And 2018, 2019, 2021, and 2022, 2023 in May, and 2023 on October. So I've been always trying to capture the beauty, but it's impossible to run from the war in my country.
And Mataz, I mean, the images before October and after are so striking. I want to now show a photo of a toddler gravely injured in a strike. If you can tell us what happened to this two-year-old child named Jude. The Palestine Children's Relief Fund has evacuated him to Chicago. You know, on your trip, you met a child in Dallas for the 5K run who'd been evacuated. I saw you in Brooklyn when you met a little boy who had been evacuated, who was gravely injured. Tell us about Jude.
I remember that day when I took the picture for Jude. I used my imagination. Like every young boy, he's dreamed like to be like a Spider-Man. But this boy was really deeply injured, and his hands and his legs, like, he can't move. And like, I don't know, in this moment, I remember that this boy, he will be in love like in Superman and Spider-Man. But like I saw like his image, like the moves of like Spider-Man, but the same thing, he's injured, he can't move, he lost his mom, he lost his family, and his father, he didn't come to the hospital yet, he was like alone on the ground, there is no free space or space for him to find a bed in the hospital. So I took this picture, I shared the story, and thank God, this picture, it was like a reason to save his life. So he's now like getting a treatment. He's now in the U.S. with his father, and I'm happy for him. But at the same time, I'm really sorry for the thousands of children that I wish to take a picture for everyone to show the world that Israel is targeting our children. Israel is targeting our babies, targeting our mothers, targeting our families. I just want to show the whole world so maybe I can bring help to my people through my photography.
And Mataz, can you talk about what it was like for you yourself to have to flee Gaza? Do you still have family there? Describe your journey out.
Yeah, my whole family is there. My whole relatives is there. I'm originally from Deir el-Balah city. I'm originally from Gaza Strip. So my whole family is still there. It wasn't an option for me to leave. It wasn't an option for me to stay. The last days before I leave, I've been suffering to find food, to find tents for, like, in order if something happened. Israeli tanks, it's like at the end of my street. And I was, like, suffering, and I stopped doing my work, like, just to find water, to find food, to find diesel for the car. So everything was really complicated. And the risk is so high. After I lost two of my colleagues, Hamza Dahdouh, the son of Wael Dahdouh, and Mustafa Abutraya, the drone friend who was taking the drone shots for me, it was really hard for me to stay, and there was no protection for me as a journalist. And I don't want to lose like a part of my body to just show the world, and to lose my life, to lose my parents, and I already lost 25 of my family, of my relatives, 18 of my friends. I lost my whole life, so I didn't think that day, like, I need to lose more. For me, okay, maybe I will sacrifice my life if to do a change. But I'm seeing more than 175 euros got killed in front of the whole world, and nothing changed. So, and I got refused by Israel to leave twice. It wasn't easy. And I thought maybe when I'll go out, I'll make more changes, I'll do something more on the ground to be between the people. And here I am. It's been a year. I'm trying to do something to stop this, or at least to protect the civilians.
And Mataz, as we talked about this weekend, that moment that was so moving of you taking off your press flak jacket with your colleagues around you, taking off the jacket with you as a kind of communal effort when you left with your parents and siblings, ultimately, Gaza.
I wish I took the jacket with me. It wasn't allowed because it's like, and the borders, you believe it's a kind of armor, so you can't take it. But it was a thing that I, from day one with me. It wasn't going to protect me if the Israel decide to target me with, like, drones.
You had gotten calls
snipers
on your phone, Mataz? Explain that.
Yeah, it was a calls from no caller ID, but it's now for Gazans, no caller ID that mean the IDF, so or the IOF. So yeah, they were like asking me to not go there, order me like to not go there, to not okay show something else, don't go to this area, and you will be killed if you went there. Stick to the sea. You're not doing the right work. You should do something else. And I believe the millions of the people who followed me, this made some protection for Mataz, that the whole world is watching him. And if something happened, it's in front of the millions of the people. So I felt that maybe the millions that made them speak to me in a way that's not just, okay, we will kill you or do something for you.
And Mutaz, finally, you went earlier this year in April to the pro-Palestinian student encampment at Columbia University. Your response to the protests and what you'd like to see happen here?
I would like to see everyone standing for us, standing for the humanity, standing for the right of Palestinians and their land. I want to see the white people, the black people, the everyone here in the U.S. standing for the right, on the right side of the history. I want to see everyone just standing for humanity. Stop watching us being killed. Stop paying your taxes and sending for Israel as weapons to kill the Palestinians who even don't have an army. So, just support us to get our right in our land, to get our free Palestine. It's not hard. It can be done, but we need a real stand with Palestinians, people.
Mutaz Azeza, we want to thank you so much for being with us, acclaimed Palestinian photographer who documented the first 108 days of Israel's assault on Gaza. Thank you so much for joining us from Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now! We end today's show in Florida, where Hurricane Milton's approaching the state's west coast from the Gulf of Mexico as a catastrophic Category 5 storm, perhaps the strongest storm there in a century. The area is still recovering from the storm surge from Hurricane Helene 2 weeks ago. We're going now to Sean Canaan, WMNF news director, who's based in Tampa, but reporting live from the beach in Gulfport, Florida. We just have 2 minutes, Sean, but we needed to get to you before the end of the show to talk about the preparations, millions being told to evacuate. Describe what you're seeing.
Yeah, the rain is coming down hard now. A storm surge where I am in Gulfport, which is in Pinellas County near St. Petersburg. The storm surge hasn't started yet, but we are anticipating very strong storm surge. Right now, the storm is 250 miles southwest of Tampa, and tens of thousands of people have been ordered to evacuate. Because we just had a hurricane 13 days ago, and there was a lot of loss of life and a lot of damage, people are, in general, heeding those evacuation orders. Right now, the projection, Amy, is for the landfall to occur tonight, maybe around midnight, maybe a little after or before midnight, and perhaps south of Tampa Bay, which would be good news for Tampa Bay, would be less storm surge, but it would be very, very bad news for the people living along the beaches of Sarasota, of Bradenton, and all the way south to Venice and Fort Myers. We're anticipating up to 15 feet of storm surge. What I'm seeing now is I'm seeing the debris from 2 weeks ago. There are at least six sailboats here beached on the ground from that previous storm. There's piles of debris all along the road that will become missiles during the high winds and will become battering rams when the storm surge enters into this area. So people are aware the businesses are boarded up, and there's lots of people who have heeded those evacuation orders to get out.
And Sean, where exactly are they going? Are there evacuation centers set up?
There are lots and lots of places nearby that people can go to, schools on higher grounds. A lot of people made the decision to evacuate by the highways, Nermeen, to go to Georgia or to go to inland in Florida. But there are options for people, and there's still maybe a little bit of time for people to take heed to evacuate. But I really want to stress that this is going to be a very, very serious event, especially for people along the beaches. It's in Manatee County, Sarasota, Bradenton, and south.
Especially a time for a community radio station like WMNF to be such an essential provider of accurate information. We want to thank Sean Canaan for being with us, WMNF news director based in Tampa, but he's now reporting live for us from the beach in Gulfport, Florida. We will continue to do coverage of this storm in the coming days. This is Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Fels, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Wernoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is the place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, B.C.,